Hello, I'm John Kelly, and this is a podcast of Mystery Train. For rights reasons, the music is shorter than in the original programme. Mystery Train hits the rails Sunday to Thursday at 7 p.m. on RTE Lyric FM. And that's Sarah Vaughan from an album called In the Land of Hi-Fi and a version of Somewhere Over the Rainbow. You'll understand why I've just played that when I introduce my guest. Because tonight on Mystery Train, it being the Sunday special, we invite someone in to pick all the tunes. And tonight, it's one of our finest artists, someone who has represented this country all over the world for quite some time now with some extraordinary work. The great Dorothy Cross is with me in studio. Dorothy, lovely to see you.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming in. You're going to pick the tunes tonight, so let's start in what seems to me the grand surroundings of Montanati. It does conjure up in my mind notions of John McCormack and pianos for some reason.
Yes, yes. There was a piano that nobody played, but Montanati, very beautiful hillside neighbourhood in Cork. Big houses that were kind of cracked and faded and had the aesthetic of kind of Northern Italy and had were named as such, as in Montanati and Tivoli. Yeah. So there was kind of a grandeur in the naming, actually, an exotic kind of quality to that. But and they were beautiful houses. And my mother had a real kind of aesthetic of, in some sense, very slight. She would put one flower in one vase and one painting on one wall. There was no clutter. Freezing cold house.
Right.
But beautiful.
And was it an artistic kind of a house?
It was an artistic house, visually artistic, looking back. And recently I did a book actually called Montanati.
Yeah.
Where I used photographs my father took of my mother in that house. She had an amazing eye. You know, she had an eye for Japanese porcelain, and one of which I broke with a tennis ball when I was about 8. But yes, I was very lucky that she kind of instilled that type of aesthetic.
How connected were you to Cork City? Because when I think about porcelain and tennis and all of that, you know, the houses up on the hill, it does sound like you're somehow apart from the rest of the Corkonians. I'm sure you weren't, but it feels that way.
Well, I was a swimmer, you see, so I was right down there in the smelly old chlorine-filled pool in Eglinton Street, you know, so that was, you know, the common pooling of us all.
And we come back to the swimming, because you were more than a swimmer. You were a serious swimmer.
Serious swimmer.
Champion
yeah.
swimmer.
Yeah.
And still a swimmer.
Well, not really compared to a lot of people. My sister is still a swimmer. She still competes and swam the Hellespont and the Bosphorus, but I don't, actually. I dip and I scuba dive, which is about not swimming.
Well, we'll come back to all of that. First musical choice, I see, is the Mamas and Papas. I was hoping it'd be John McCormack, but there, it's the Mamas and Papas. What have you chosen, Dorothy, and why?
A Dream, a Little Dream of Me.
Ah, this is cute and gorgeous.
Cute and gorgeous.
The Mamas and Papas and Dream a Little Dream of Me, the first choice of Dorothy Cross, who's with me tonight in studio. I'm really looking forward to Dorothy's music. We've just established her Montanati credentials. again, I'm not having a go at Montanati. I've never been there. But was it all classical music, and was it all kind of Palm Court, kind of Noel Coward and stuff like that? I hate to stereotype you.
Well, our house wasn't, you know, we weren't a singing household or a playing instruments. I tried to play the piano and the guitar, but my mother, it was John McCormack, it was yeah. Strauss waltzes,
yeah.
It was Joan Sutherland, and it was Delia Murphy.
Ah, Delia got
I nearly put Delia on the list.
Oh, you should have done.
I should have.
We get her again. So Delia was on the list
she
as
was,
well.
She was, yeah.
Oh, very
yeah,
good.
Yeah. And the singing nun.
Oh, right. There was always a singing nun.
Dominique.
Wow. Now, what about what we called in those days popular music? Pop music.
Pop Monkees.
The Monkees.
The Monkees were the beginning. I was a member of the fan club.
Were you really?
Then the Beatles, of course.
Yeah. I mean, the Monkees weren't even a real band.
No, they weren't. No, it was TV, you know, and I used to go to my cousins to watch them.
Yeah.
You know? And when you listen back, you realise just how terrible their songs were.
Oh, some of the songs are great, though. Last Train to Clarksville and a few others.
Terrific. How many other programmes can we do?
Yeah. And funny, you got into the Beatles, you got into the Monkees before the Beatles.
Yes.
Which is quite odd.
Yes. My brother kind of introduced me to the Beatles.
Yeah.
Twist and Shout. I remember the cover of the EP, absolutely clearly. They were jumping off a wall in black and white.
Right. And what was your What effect did the Beatles have on you?
I kind of thought I should listen to them in a funny way because my brother gave them to me.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, they confused me in a way because they changed so much, you know, and of course we all followed them. And then, you know, Yellow Submarine came out and you were just going, what is that? So they were kind of confusing and you loved some and didn't love others, you know.
Looking back on it, though, there was a fair amount of art going on in the Beatles, too, wasn't there?
I guess so.
Visual art, but also the influences that were coming in. But, of course, none of us were aware of that at the time.
Yeah, and I suppose drugs. And then John and Yoko was actually a lovely shift, in a way, to how to live in a strange way, publicly, of course. But there was an aesthetic around that that changed, you know, the whiteness, and I was quite conscious of that.
Sure.
And the strangeness of it.
Mm. And were you as a teenager, were you comfortable in Cork, or were you, like a lot of teenagers, anxious to get somewhere else?
I was comfortable in Cork because I had a whole other life besides school, which was a swimming life.
Mm.
And we also lived by the sea for 3 months of the year. And that's where the mamas and papas, and actually I was going to go for the Beach Boys as well, which I loved. Because my sister was a surfer and, you know, was very much about that beach thing. But yes, I was happy in Cork because of swimming, I think. It was such a routine.
So tell me about that, because you were a champion swimmer. Breaststroke, I think, wasn't
it? Yeah.
What was the routine? Because I know some kids nowadays who swim and they're going getting up at 4 a.m. and things.
We got up at 6 and we were in the pool from 7 to 8:30 every single morning for like 360 days of the year. And it was hard. And, you know, the pools were very primitive in those days. Those kind of slimy wooden kind of changing cubicles along the side that had these vinyl kind of blue and white kind of drapes that you kind of got changed behind. But my brother was the coach. He was a national coach, and his friend Jimmy Martin. So it was very much, he became my surrogate father, really. He got us up in the morning, brought us to the pool. And you did it because it was... I always loved water anyway, but also you were told you'll get to go and swim in Iceland or you'll get to go and swim somewhere else. So it was a way of being very international at a very young age. You know, we swam all over the world, Lisbon, wherever, you know, Catholic student games. So it was actually a way out. It was a way of travel,
sure,
too. But you had to work really hard.
How far did you take the swimming?
Well, you know, the Irish team, but then I've spoken about this before. I failed with the Olympics. I failed by 0.1 of a second for the 100-metre breaststroke qualifying time. But also, I didn't train hard enough. So, you know, I didn't deserve to make it. And there was some sense I had where I didn't want to drive myself to be, come last in the Olympics. There was something about that. I wasn't driven enough.
Right. Okay.
It was easy to be the best in Ireland then. Maybe a little less easy now. You probably have to train twice as much now than I did in those days, you know.
Wow. And you're only, what, 15, 16?
Well, yeah, actually 13, 14, 15, 16. I didn't improve after the 16, really.
Okay. Well, let's have another musical choice, Dorothy. Oh, no, you have, as it happens, Joan Sutherland. This is the sound of Montanotti.
And this is what my mother loved.
This is Radio Montanotti. Come on. Dorothy Cross in studio tonight, picking all the music, and what a tune that is.
Beautiful tune.
Dreamt I Dwelt in Marble Halls, and that was Dame Joan Sutherland singing it there. I think through the course of your own practice, Dorothy, your own work, you keep in touch with all sorts of music, don't you, really?
Yes, and I was introduced to opera kind of really kind of more seriously later on. But that I Dwelt in Marble Halls has a real Montanotti tone for me, because I think when you are brought up in very big rooms, you kind of would love them to be lined with marble. But my mother adored that song, so that's why I chose that one. But yes, later on I have worked, I now adore opera.
And I ask everybody this who mentions opera on the programme, where do you listen to it? In what circumstances can you successfully listen to opera? Because I have trouble finding the right sort of atmosphere to put it on and be able to listen to it.
Well, I'd listen to it in the studio.
As you work,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah, as I kind of mess around, yeah, and kind of gather and just, you know. And then, of course, live, you know.
Well, live's different, isn't it? Then you can kind of commit to the thing properly.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
So we were talking earlier about the swimming, and that was your teens and great devotion. And you said you kind of knocked it on the head to a degree, at least at that level, for just missing the Olympics. What ridiculous! What was it?
1.1 of a second.
1 of a second. Now, where did the interest then in visual art come in at that point?
Oh, it was there right through school. You know, I went in for all these Texaco children arts competitions and things like that. We had a funny little school called Miss O'Sullivan's in the middle of Cork City. And there was no art room. There was no domestic science room. There was no sciences, actually. There was no physics and chemistry. Down the back of the class, we used to paint on our desks. And I painted a lot of the time. That was my, as well as swimming, that was the other thing. So I painted. I never paint now.
Not at all, no.
No.
And so you were self-taught then, were you?
No, we had a teacher who taught us, but she told us that to paint skin, you should mix kind of chestnut brown with yellow. So when I look back at all my early paintings, these people have this like fake tans.
Yeah. But the facility that you had for it, I mean, did you just discover that sort of by chance?
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. And there was encouragement in the house.
Right.
There was.
And what form did that take? I mean, were there art books in your huge library and all that kind of thing?
More old-fashioned stuff, yeah. Yes. And, interest just from both parents in like, oh, what are you doing now? That's interesting.
Right. Okay.
And it was looking at narrative. My early paintings were all kind of Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane, like really strange, or the Three Witches of Macbeth. So they were quite narrative.
Yeah.
So they were fed by, you know, I suppose the education through Shakespeare and all that. And I tried to illustrate and represent in those days.
Yeah. And at what point did you think you might study this? You might take it further?
It was always this kind of mixture between it's not academic, it's not something that's taken seriously, and you should go to university first, perhaps, and do something more serious. Mm. And I had aunts and uncles who were all doctors and things, so there was a bit of that tone, and that you'll never make any money doing art. But in my heart, my brother is a scientist, a zoologist, and I adored the way he worked, and he went investigating mussels and starfish and salmon and everything around the country. But I went for the art because I think I enjoyed it so much. And then later in life realised by being an artist, you've access to every place in the world. You've access to science. You've access to anything you really desire to enter into.
If you're open-minded enough, when you're broad-minded, yeah. What artists, when you were in your teens, would have interested you, would have, if not inspired you, at least attracted your attention?
Rodin, Giacometti, and I used to get these Time Life books of famous artists and go through them. And I used to copy their, in pencil, I used to copy their, God, funny, nerdy thing to do, I used to copy the paintings in pencil.
Those were two sculptors you mentioned, though.
Yeah,
Giacometti.
That's true.
And of course,
that's
he was a painter as well, but Giacometti and Rodin. Yeah. Sculpture seemed to be another world sometimes, because even if you, no matter what art you did at school, however little, usually all you saw were paintings.
That's right. But we had Seamus Murphy in Cork, and he was such a lovely old man, and you'd see him out there, and he was famous for being a sculptor. Mm. And I encountered him once because he used to come to my friend's house for dinner, and he arrived with a little cardboard box with a bird that he'd found that had fallen out of a tree in a little nest of grass that he'd brought to kind of hope that the bird would survive. And that was another side of this man who, you know, carved stone. And looking back on that, it was such a beautiful poetic thing. And he was a very gentle man.
And when you think of your work, I mean, that must have been a moment, actually.
Yeah, retrospectively, I guess, yes, definitely.
We'll put up some links to Dorothy's website, and you can see, if you don't know Dorothy's work already, I recommend you check. There's quite a few images on your website, and people can see the whale and the shark and the various things that we can probably talk about as time goes on. Another piece of music, Dorothy, if you will, and a bird, indeed, a blackbird in this case. And we mentioned the Beatles earlier. This is the thing of extraordinary beauty, this song, isn't it? I think it's McCartney's greatest moment. Blackbird, the Beatles. Paul McCartney's song there, sung by Paul. And that's from Dorothy Cross's wonderful list of music that sits in front of me here. And Dorothy's picking all the tunes tonight. That was gorgeous. So, where are we? We've had the Beatles, we've had Dame Joan Sutherland, we've had the Mamas and Papas. And that's all making sense. It's all making perfect sense.
One version.
In terms of the studying and the art, when you went off to study art first, Dorothy, where did you go? Where was the first place?
I did 1 year in Cork School of Art in the Crawford, which was called a foundation. Then I went to England to Leicester Polytechnic. Right. Weirdly kind of fell into this school of design because I felt that art didn't really exist in Ireland. I don't know why, but I thought that. So I thought I had to go abroad. And
were you right or wrong about that?
You know, I don't know. You know, because other artists of my generation went through the system there and survived and came out the other end. I think it was just about me thinking that it had to be somewhere else.
And Leicester doesn't sound particularly exotic.
Oh my God, Leicester was so depressing. Yeah. It was in the years of the Birmingham bombings, which were just up the road. And I was in the School of Industrial Design, kind of by mistake, because I had researched it wrong and ended up living in this place with an outside toilet and, you know, used to go swimming to kind of have a shower and things like that. It was really, really rough. But I learnt a lot of skills like metalwork and welding and woodwork through that design course. So as a base, it was interesting, but as a way to fly, it wasn't really.
And having done a foundation course and a design course, at what point were you even at that stage thinking of what you might do with these skills?
Well, you mean get a job or something?
No, in terms of practice. I mean, were you just thinking, well, I'll do welding because that might be useful, or I'll do this because, or did you?
No,
want?
It always led to making something. So it wasn't so much about learning the skill. I always wanted to make something with those skills, as I did the different techniques. But then, when I finished in Leicester, I still didn't want to come back to Ireland. So I applied to the San Francisco Art Institute to do an MFA, and then I went to San Francisco, which was a whole different ballgame. It's, you know, it's sunshine, it's a beautiful city, and it was a school of fine art. So then I was really in the flow. There they wanted to ask you about what art meant, and of course I couldn't tell them. And then I had to learn how to lie about it.
Right.
And I used Samuel Beckett as my kind of cipher. And I hid behind his plays and, of course, adored him and adored his plays. So he was my way of being. And I made loads and loads of prints based on Endgame and Crap's Last Tape and things like that.
Is it normal for an artist to go through an educational process where you, at one minute, you're in a college of design and the next thing you're doing fine art and the next, you know, you seem to have got a very broad spread.
Yeah, it was a bit all over the place,
which is great.
I feel great about it because, you know, I never know where my art's going to come from next because I don't work in one way, in one medium, you know. And I sometimes envy, you know, for example, painters who have one kind of way of working and you can recognise them for their entire lives. They just change the colour. But I wake up tomorrow morning, I don't know what I'm going to work on until something strikes me.
Mm.
And that's how it works.
What was San Francisco like?
Great.
And what year was that, by the way?
It was 78 to 83.
Right.
It was beautiful. It was near nature. Now, this maybe was the beginning, like compared to Leicester Polytechnic. It was after the big rush of the 60s and the Art Institute in San Francisco were amazing. So it wasn't as wild as it was then, because it was the late 70s. But we had great visiting artists. You know, we had David Hockney and John Cage, and we had Robert Mapplethorpe.
Really?
Yeah, fabulous.
Tell me a little bit about encounters with those people. What was Cage like? He's a fascinating.
Well, Cage actually, it was so crowded. I was outside the auditorium, you know, not even seeing it. And his exhibition was of those colour prints he did that represented sound. So that's really what he was speaking about, which was kind of fabulous. It's a bit like that Fellini film. Was it The Tall Ships Pass By, where a woman is singing next to a piano, and as she's singing, she goes Schwarz or yellow or pink, and it's like this colour that represents sound, which is what Oliver Sacks calls, I can't remember.
Oh, synesthesia, is it?
Yes.
Yeah.
And so his prints were kind of like that in a funny way. So it was his entry into the visual more than his music or lack of music. Whereas Robert Mapplethorpe was fabulous. All the heavy-duty feminists were outside the auditorium ready to kind of really give him a lot of grief because, you know, he did a lot of work with sexual images, mm-hmm. And which were quite, you know, in those days, quite shocking. Yeah. And he came and he was so gentle and gorgeous. And he wore his leather jacket and he sat on a stool. And I really loved him. And appreciated his work much more after that. You know, you go from his lilies to the sexual image, and you kind of understand him in a way.
Yeah. And what about Hockney? Because I always enjoyed, I never met him, but I always enjoyed listening to him whenever he was on television. I always found him an interesting communicator as well as an artist.
Yeah, he was kind of like an old man even then, you know, with his funny little shoes and his coloured clothes. But American students devour you when you're a visiting artist. They want you for breakfast, dinner and tea. You know, so they made him breakfast. It was all different colours of his paintings, you know. And he was sweet. He just was himself. There was nothing very dramatic about him. And I loved his early paper pulp casts and all that work. I was very fond of in those days. Very Californian.
Well, I want to talk about your own practice now. It developed, but we'll have another piece of music. And we're back with the classical again. Some music from Handel in this case. Music there from Handel, Lassia Jo Pianga from Handel, a choice of Dorothy Cross. See what I did there? Dorothy Cross is picking the music tonight. So, Dorothy, to talk about your own practice, because I've spoken to quite a few artists over the years, and I can never quite figure out how they go from being art student to art practitioner and at what point they strike out on their own, because presumably when you're at an art college of any sort, you're being told to some extent what to do or what to explore or what you have to, but yet at some point you must start thinking, right, I don't care what they're telling me, this is what I'm about.
I think it depends on the character. Somehow I always knew it was kind of in the routine of the day. It was hard to separate where art from the rest of my life. So even though I was in educational institutions, it you know, when I came out, it wasn't that different. And maybe that's because I didn't have a true master teaching me. Mm-hmm. And maybe I looked at other artists that I didn't even encounter a lot of the time to learn from. And one might have just used the facilities. But I think it is a problem in art colleges sometimes that they don't, students and artists, young artists, don't learn how to speak about the work and how to survive outside. And actually there's a fantastic new educational competition called Articulation that was set up by Madeleine Bessborough in England, and then through Lismore Arts they get kids in transition year, 15, 16 year olds, to come and talk about an artist of their choice for 10 minutes.
Right.
And it's amazing because they have to impassion themselves about whoever they've chosen. And in some way, at that point in their lives, I think that can inform them for their own roles as artists.
Sure.
Whereas, you know, in art college, there's a lot of students don't know how to even speak about what they're impassioned by.
And presumably kids in transition year will not yet have been polluted by art speak.
So exactly.
What they say is genuinely what they mean.
Yeah, yeah.
No, I remember meeting a young artist out of art college once who I had to write something about the exhibition, and there was an insistence that I include a certain quote. And I said, I'm not sure what it means. You tell me what it means. And the artist in question didn't know what it meant either. But it was apparently the way this artist's work was being defined. Mm. And the artist didn't know what it meant. So I thought, this is dodgy.
Yes.
This is suspicious.
Yes. Well, words in general around art are problematic.
Yeah.
Says she speaking.
Talking
here.
About it at all.
Yes.
On the radio.
Yes. But that's why I do it, because I actually feel it's important to, because I think people are afraid of art, so it's important to talk about it.
And in terms of what you were, as you leave art college, you leave the various art colleges you were at, was there a specific area or discipline that you had that you thought, this is what I'm going to follow through in my career? Or did you always know you were going to end up in a studio doing all sorts of things with all sorts of materials and all sorts of skills would have to be employed?
Well, I don't ever look ahead. You know, I have friends who make 5-year plans. I never made a plan about anything. Mm. I had desires that I hoped for, I guess. So when I finished in my MFA in California at the Art Institute, I worked in a shop, and then I went down to South America. And I used to start collecting like bits of string out on, you know, the middle of Lake Titicaca, and which later might have ended up in some funny little thing I was building. So it's all tied in.
But you didn't come out as, say, a painter. You didn't come out as a sculptor. You didn't come out as anything in particular.
No.
So then you went off to find out, well, to discover the world, really.
Well, that's what art really is about, isn't it? It's all tied up, and I think the problem can be if it's too separate from life. Because if somebody loves art and if they want to live with it, they can bring it into their home. So that then becomes part of their own lives. Or you go to a museum and you see art, or whatever. Or you can walk down the street and see something that is art without it being told, without being told that it's art. Like my nephew the other day said to me. He's in his 30s, and he said, is it art? Like when I look at my friend snowboarding down a mountain and he leaves a trail, a beautiful trail on pure powder snow down the mountain, is that art? And I loved that he asked me that question. But it's about how you look at that trail and how you consider that in relationship to your life and the globe and the universe and everything.
Well, how did you answer that question?
That's what I said.
Just that?
Yeah.
So you
is that understandable?
Yeah, if you relate the thing to your own life, then it's art.
But yes. But, you know, obviously a lot of things that are called art are not going to do anything for you. So not everything that is called art
is art
for you.
Right.
I'm being diplomatic here a little bit. But, you know, there are many, many different types of things that are called art. And, you know, there are things you love and there are things you don't love. So I would talk a little bit about art as a relationship. I often talk about art as a relationship. So it's about your response and interaction and molecular response to something that you encounter that is like a relationship. It's like talking to you here or looking at a Joseph Beuys or, you know, it is about a focus that results in some energetic relationship.
For instance, you know, I can see you going around the world and you're picking things up and gathering things. And now I know your work, and I've been a fan of your work, as you know, for a very long time. So if I see, for instance, a skull of something, and I'm looking at that, and it's extraordinary. But it was extraordinary before you picked it up, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
It was extraordinary before you brought it into the gallery.
Yes.
I suppose it takes the artist, it takes you, to notice this while it's still lying half buried in the sand or under a tree somewhere.
But you see, yes, and it's great that you get to see the skull in nature. That's the most powerful thing. I think, essentially, that's more powerful than what I'm trying to do, some might argue. But what I will never take something and just represent it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what I try and do is take the skull and bring something together with it, mm-hmm, to make some other explosion of potential meaning, response, excitement, confusion, hatred, whatever it is. Well, hatred's a bit strong. But anger, whatever emotion it brings up. So talking about skull, you know, I found a skull in a hat box in Herbert Park when I was about 28. And it was an anatomical specimen used for teaching. And I was digging around in the skip looking for bits of furniture like one did when one lived in California. And obviously someone had died, and maybe they were a doctor and had this object that was an educational tool. In those days, you still used human bone to educate. It was in all the parts, 22 bones in the human skull. And recently, I've used some of those pieces and gilded the inside with pure gold in respect of the past human, and then worked with meteorites in relationship to them. Mm-hmm. So that you have this meteorite that's come from celestial territory and landed on Earth. And then you have this human that has passed from body and possibly or hopefully might have entered the celestial or whatever it is we're going to enter into. So that thing of just taking something and placing it, I don't do.
Even though you found it in a hat box. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
a skull in a hat box already sounds like.
Well, it wasn't quite a hat box. It was an anatomical box that was, I knew what it was because my aunt in Montanotti, May O'Donovan, was the first pathologist woman to study in Cork. And she studied when the Black and Tans were shooting out in the South Mall with a candle on the floor of their house in Sullivan's Quay because she had to study. And she was born in 1898 or something. And she had these bits of skull in her house. And so I knew exactly that it was an anatomical box when I saw it.
Again, I'll refer people to our website because I know it's on the Carlin site, that skull you're talking about with the meteorite inside it, that's there. Another musical choice, Dorothy. This is music from Stabat Mater, Quando Corpus. So we're into the physical again here, Dorothy, and death, clearly. This is music from Pergolesi. Music there from Pergolesi, the choice of Dorothy Cross, is with me in studio. Dorothy's picking all the music tonight. Pergolesi, Stabat Mater. It's extraordinarily beautiful, isn't
incredibly
it?
Beautiful, yeah.
But it's tied up with what we were talking about there in terms of the work, because that's all about the body and the end.
That's right, yeah. Or the beginning.
Yes,
we... and. I did the Pergolesi Stabat Mater in a cave on Valentia Island about 10 years ago with Opera Theatre Company. So, and that's one of the final pieces of music from that sequence of
music.
What
did that sound like in a cave?
Stunning.
Must have been.
Because I went up into that cave that's the slate quarry in Valentia and just went immediately opera. And had worked a bit in opera before with James Conway and that's where he introduced me really to Handel. That's why I loved Handel. And I went, oh my God, we have to do something here. And there's the remains of kind of 1950s Marian year kind of altar and a pelican and a fountain and then a Virgin Mary like hundreds of feet up in a cleft in the cliff. And slate being quarried at the same time. So I came up with this idea of doing the Pergolesi Stabat Mater there, which is about evangelists actually singing at the foot of the dying Christ and telling us that we have to become more holy, really, and that the body is something that is limited and just for a short period of time, and that what's after is much more important. And what we did was, it was Linda Lee, soprano Linda Lee, and countertenor Jonathan Peter Kenny. They were the only two singers, and then we had a baroque group of players dressed in filthy, dirty overalls that we took from the workers from the quarry, and then we gave them some nice new ones. And it was almost like they've come off a break from work, and they came into this giant big space and started playing this exquisite music. And we actually used the trumpet to introduce it, like this kind of strange
fanfare
that began it. And then Linda and Jonathan sang these extraordinary pieces and then returned back into the back of the cave, where we had this giant movie screen that rolled forward on tracks and then started blaring out the noise of machines. So you had this absolute contrast. It was almost sacrilegious after the Pergolesi, this screech and scream of machines. And it felt to me almost like the Angelus, because it's a short piece of music. He wrote it when he was only 29, I think. He died when he was 29, 28, 29. Can you imagine?
I know.
And
29, I couldn't tie my shoelaces.
I know. Just amazing.
I don't think I've asked you this before, but in the context of so much of your work involving bones, skulls, skeletons, stuffed birds, et cetera, a lot of death or life, whatever way you want to look at it, are you a believer of any sort?
I should have had the monkeys for that. I'm a believer.
We can get it for you. Do you want to hear it?
No, I don't know that I do. Anyone of my generation will know it. But I'm a speculator. A believer means one. I always feel it means one belief.
Yeah.
I'm a multiple believer.
Right.
I'm really curious and frustrated.
Does that include not believing?
No, it doesn't actually.
Right. But an afterlife of some sort.
Well, life, you see, is the confusing word there. An after of some sort. Or a now of more developed curiosity and significance of consideration of belief or lack of belief. So it's about trying to look at how we function in the world and either block our energies or allow them to thrive. Like even the way we've removed ourselves from our animal existences, I find that a tragedy. Mm. And later we'll play a piece by a shark caller who lived so symbiotically between nature and his own tribal life in Papua New Guinea. But I think for me, It's an organic thing that's connected to the spiritual world. Now, I'm speaking. When I speak like this, John, I don't know what I'm saying. But usually it makes sense in the end. And it's very important to talk like that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, well, of course, because none of us know what we're talking about.
Yeah.
In this regard, in particular. Now, people will purport to know exactly what they're talking about, and of course they don't.
But it's important to speak about what we don't know and accommodate potential.
Yeah.
Because that, I think, inherently holds in it progress.
And is that in your work, do you think?
I hope it is.
Yeah, yeah. Because it would, you know, as I say, a lot of bones and skulls and death and so on. You kind of might, you might think that's what it's about.
That's about the fourth time you said that.
Well, you're the one makes
that. Let that one in.
You're the one. You're the one does it. let's talk about the way you work as well, and the process. Tell me about your arrival in the west of Ireland and all of that, because you kind of arrived and just sort of, I was going to say, set up shop. You didn't even have a shop.
No, I didn't. I went there after I had learned how to scuba dive in the Galapagos Islands. And
all right, let's start there.
OK.
You went to the Galapagos Islands.
I went to the Galapagos Islands because I had this desire to go. And I know it's kind of not very good for humans to go there because we're destroying it. But I went there, mea culpa, quite a long time ago. It was in the early 90s. And I scuba dived with the only dive master who was there at the time. And then I wasn't qualified, so then I came back to live in Dublin, where
well,
I was.
When you were there, did you see the iguanas and all that? When
oh,
you were diving?
See,
yeah, because they swim, don't they? That's
oh,
the
they
thing
do.
About
they're
them.
Incredible,
yeah.
Actually. Yeah. Diving with iguanas because they feed on algae on the bottom of the sea, and they go down, and it's so primitive when you see an iguana diving. I've never seen a crocodile, and I think I'd die of fright. Like sharks, I adore, but I think if I saw a salty crocodile, I'd die of fright. I find them much more terrifying. But the first gulp I took of air out of my tank with Fernando looking into my eyes, because it was, I was a swimmer, but diving is very different. It's about not swimming and it's about trusting your equipment. The sea lion just came and stuck its head between me and Fernando. And because they were so separated from, in the Humboldt Current, from humans for so many centuries, the animals are not afraid of humans.
Right.
So that's the big, beautiful aspect of Galapagos. So iguanas walk over your feet, pelicans almost land on your head, sea lions play with you when you're diving. And that's where I first dived with shark, and it was extraordinary.
What is that like? Because I know we've all grown to respect sharks more than we used to, but I mean, I can't help being terrified of the idea of a shark, particularly a large one. What was it like for you when you get in the water with one?
No, the night before I was to go, I was terrified. I had desperate dreams about hammerheads kind of rearing up and really, really scared. But, you know, when you're down there with them, it's far less terrifying than if you see a fin on the surface of the water.
Mm.
And you feel incubated, and they take no notice of you most of the time. But now with Instagram and a lot of, the internet and everything, there are a lot of people who are acknowledging that sharks aren't, the majority of sharks are not threatening and are not violent. And it's fantastic to see because they're so maligned and they're so threatened by finning. You know, the Chinese are still making shark fin soup. It's an abomination because what they do is they catch these shark on long lines a lot of the time, which means thousands of metres of line. They chop the fins off and throw the animal back into the sea, which in effect is like putting a human being back in without arms and legs. So they drown and they're not even using the meat from their bodies. So it is, and they're one of the most ancient animals on the planet. So it's a real, you know, there needs to be a lot of work done to try and save them because some of the species are nearly extinct.
Actually, should we play the shark calling now while
yeah,
we're talking about it?
Yeah, let's do that. Let's do
that. Tell me about that, because this was in the Pacific somewhere.
This was
it?
On an island called New Ireland.
Which is where? Where's
it's
that
off,
near?
It's off Papua New Guinea.
Right. And so just before we play the piece of music, what happens?
In the piece of music or
well,
down
the,
there?
Well, this idea of shark calling.
I knew about this tradition of shark calling, which is in these tribal parts of Papua New Guinea, where men go out in small outriggers and they sing and rattle to try and lure sharks up from the depth to catch and kill and eat. But they believe that the sharks are guided by their ancestors. So it's totally tied into ancestral respect. So I went down there with a very good friend of mine And we stayed 3 weeks in one of the most primitive places that I've ever been in my life. They still were using shell money, and they sang in harmony on the reefs when we arrived. It was like I expected Marlon Brando to pop up from behind a palm tree. It was extraordinary. And they still, you know, wear leaves in their hair. They might have a Nike T-shirt on too. Mm. But, you know, they were so excited when we had a newspaper to roll their tobacco in. And they walk around with logs that they use as cigarette lighters that are just smouldering. It's really primitive. So I met a man called Salam Kerasimbe, who I had seen in a Cousteau film. He'd been filmed by two people who I had researched, and when he was young, and he was the hero shark caller. So I arrived down there not knowing if he was alive or dead. They gave me a white plastic chair in the middle of this jungle area, and they sat around listening to me, wanting to know what I wanted to do. And I saw this old man sitting under a tree, and it was Salam. And he had been outcast by the villagers because there's an awful lot of belief in black and white magic. And they believed he had lost his powers so that he was no longer able to catch shark. Now, I would say that maybe it's because there are less shark around. But anyway, he was outside the circle. So I saw him and I went rushing up to him. And they speak English because they've been colonised by so many different countries and they mainly speak pidgin English. And I said, I saw you on this film, Salam, with this amazing, gorgeous, beautiful smile. And I said, I would love if you would take me out shark calling. And I knew that it was taboo to bring women out, like it is a bit in most fishing boats around the world. But he said he would give me these herbs to wash my body before dawn the following morning, and then I to cleanse myself, and then I could go out in this boat with him. And we went out way out over the horizon, and he sang and he rattled for these sharks to appear, and we caught none. But later I recorded him singing, because they have all these songs. One young man caught a shark, and they all do these extraordinary songs when they're bringing the shark into shore. And then one kind of religious man chops the shark and gives everybody in the village a different piece of the animal. So Salam sat under a tree and I recorded him on video, and he sang this song that we're going to play.
Oh, so this is it. This is the one you recorded.
Yes.
Okay. Oh, that's beautiful. And clearly it was getting the better of the poor man singing it.
Yes, and we were filming, and in the middle of it, I thought he had something in his eye because he started rubbing his eye. And then I realised he was crying. So I went to stop the camera and he put his hand up and he wanted us to continue. And at the end of the recording, it's very clear he's crying at the end. I said, Salam, why are you crying? And he said, this song I only ever played when there was a shark in my boat and I'm returning to land on my own. Mm. And he believes the tradition of shark calling is dying because of the modern life. And he's heartbroken. Absolutely heartbroken.
That's extraordinary. And tell me, how did you then incorporate this into your own work?
You know, with difficulty, and I still wonder, should I have? Because I think it's very easy for us white, Western, privileged people to go to Papua New Guinea and film extraordinary beauty and then pop it into a museum or a gallery. And I'm very cautious of that, and I've never, ever done it before. But I showed it in the Curlin Gallery once, with an upturned curragh and a gannet flying upside down. And the curragh was fractured, nose from stern. And I had found it on the beach near my house in Connemara. And it was about that fracture between us humans and nature and culture. So the film of Salam, the video is very simple. It's just him sitting under a tree with little kids around him and the sea behind singing. And it was about that sadness of that I feel enormously. Of the separation from that kind of life.
That piece, well, let's talk. That piece you mentioned about the gannet and the upturned curragh, one of my favourite pieces of yours. And I saw it in the Carolyn, actually, and saw it in other places too, but I certainly saw it in the Carolyn. Tell me about, and this is what we were going to talk about before I distracted you with the shark calling, the move to Connemara. Because you did sort of arrive and kind of roughed it for a long time, as far as I understand, in terms of how you lived there and so on.
I had always rented studios and houses all my life, and I was getting on in age, and I went to Connemara to scuba dive with a fantastic scuba dive centre called Scuba Dive West, which is on the mouth of Kittery Harbour. And one day I saw a little hand-painted sign saying land for sale. And I thought, I'll never be able to afford it. And I didn't have any house or studio that I owned myself, because I always use my money to travel and make more art, which I'm not sorry about, actually, because I think sometimes if you wait and, you know, try and earn money to do something else, the art goes by the wayside. So I bought this field, 5 acres of land that runs down to the sea, and with no planning permission, and I fell in love with it. And there was an old ruin of a cottage there, and so I put, the first summer there was a tent, the next summer there's a little hut, and I lived in the hut, not through the winters. I still rented the studio in Dublin, and then a house came for sale 2 years later, and I moved there in 2001.
It was literally a hut, wasn't it?
The hut, yeah, in the field it was a hut.
With no facilities whatsoever?
No,
no,
but I got another
no
hut then,
water.
And I got electricity.
Wow. And I mean, I love talking to you about this because, the fact that so much of your work is based on stuff that you find actually literally washed up on your doorstep.
Mm.
Tell me how that works, because the morning that you find a whale, for instance, it must be a great day for you.
Mm, it is.
And what happens with the whale?
It's sad for the whale, though.
Well, the whale's already dead, in fairness.
I know, but the first feeling I always have is sadness.
Yeah.
Always, without a doubt. And, you know, I'm not using dead animals anymore, you might be surprised to hear, but I found a Cuvier's whale on a beach near my house, and there was a lovely farmer nearby called John Gibbons, who's since passed away, and he had a new digger machine. And I phoned him up and said, will you come and move this whale up to my land so that it can rot down and I'll get the bones? And he did. And it was like this deposition of Christ or something, this giant thing lumbering up the road with everybody going, oh, my God, you know, there's a whale on the digger. And I left it in my field for probably 3 years before it melted down to bone.
Was it buried, though, was it?
We didn't bury it. Now, there's a funny connection, because I made a film years ago about a wonderful woman who bred jellyfish, and she buried a skull in her garden in Kerry, Maud Delap. And when her skull is much darker and browner, you see, if you bury it in peat, it will start absorbing the brownness. So I wanted it to be white. And strangely, the birds didn't come and eat it was so disgusting. The birds didn't eat the flesh. In the end, it just kind of dripped off and rotted.
Well, there must have been terrible smell of it, wasn't it?
It was the prevailing winds were offshore. So most of the time we didn't smell it. And the farmer's dog every so often rolled in it.
And again, I'd draw attention to the work on the website, because the whale bones and so on, it's just magnificent.
And that piece is actually about the sadness of this vast, beautiful creature hanging it like a fishing catch by its tail over this tiny tin bucket that's rusted and on a marble plinth. So in a way, it's about our human behaviour and our treatment of such extraordinary animals.
How then do you function when you're working with other materials, metals and things that must surely involve premises that you don't have on site?
I use experts to work with. So when I'm casting bronze, I'll go to foundries and they'll make the moulds and they'll cast them in bronze. And, you know, they have the skills. I did bring a frozen shark to Bronze Art Foundry here in Dublin to make a mould one morning that was delivered from the north of Ireland. And it was very hard to get a shark, because now shark are not allowed to be sold as food, which is fantastic. And this one fishmonger up in Carlingford, as far as I remember, he said, what would you like? And I said, well, ideally a blue shark about 2 metres long. Blue sharks are very elegant. They have very long pectoral fins and they're very pointy. And you find them off the Irish coast. And he said, I'll phone you back on Monday. And he did. And there was one shark in his fridge, and it was a blue shark that was 2 metres long. And his guy delivered it in a white van to a roundabout outside Dublin. I left Connemara, picked up a frozen shark, put it on my roof, brought it to Bronze Art, and we made a mould. And it was rigid. And my dog, I've told this story before, my dog wanted to eat it when I had it in the car, so I had to put it on the roof rack. So that's part of the kind of daily, it's like the job. But you know, it's...
Well, what a job to have, though. Isn't it great that you can spend your days following your nose wherever it goes, you know?
Yeah, it's great. It is. You know, your nose, literally.
Yeah, in that case. In that case, I'd say it was. Another piece of music, Dorothy, is what? What do we have now?
What do we do next? Virginia Rodriguez is so beautiful, this Brazilian woman.
Okay, well, let's play Virginia. We have plenty of time. Virginia Rodriguez.
Okay. Found in a church in Brazil, singing.
That's Virginia Rodriguez, the choice of Dorothy Cross, who's with me in studio tonight. Dorothy's picking all the music. We'll be right back after this break. This is Mystery Train on RTE Lyric FM, the Sunday night special where we get someone in to pick the tunes. And tonight it's the artist Dorothy Cross. We're having a great time here picking some wonderful music, Dorothy. Thank you. I'm really enjoying this. Can we talk about other ways in which you'd have used music in your work? Is it ever the starting point, do you think, of your work? Does music ever come first?
It comes first when somebody asks me to work on an opera.
Right, okay.
So, for example, the Pergolesi was the cave that led me to Pergolesi. But I did a Handel Tamerlano with Opera Theatre Company and James Conway years ago. That was the first introduction. We did it in Kilmainham Jail. Beautiful, because it's about an imprisoned king who comes out from the ground in Kilmainham. So the location was perfect. And that was my introduction to Handel and loving Handel. And then the only other straight operas, for want of a better word, was Riders of the Sea with Fiona Shaw that we did in English National Opera. And Fiona's a friend of mine and she directed it and I designed it with a man called Tom Pye, who's a really proper theatre designer who helped me work out the logistics.
And of course, Fiona's Montanati as well.
She is,
so John. You go back a long way. Yeah. Yeah, I interviewed her last year. It was the first time I'd met her, actually. She was great. Mm-hmm. Really great. In fact, we have music. I know it's further down your list, but we do have music from Riders to the Sea, and maybe we should play that now when we're talking about it.
Now, there are very few recordings, I think, of Vaughan Williams's Riders of the Sea, but I put this one in because it's the famous one. They're all gone now. And we did it quite a beautiful thing with the body of Bartley, her son, who's the last son who drowns in the play, where we got the singer naked and wrapped him in a red sail in English National Opera, and he was carried on and put on a table. And when they opened the sail, water splashed out, so it was like this mad birth of her dead older son. You know, it was incredibly beautiful, actually. And it was funny with Vaughan Williams, because I didn't like the music, to be honest, and I couldn't get my head into it, but when you're working on an opera, you're sucked into this kind of vortex of black hole and you get to know every note, even if you're not a music person, and I'm not. So you become absorbed by it and you really, really know what's going on in the end through the sound. And I think it's something to do, and that's why I love opera, is it's about extremes. Now, Vaughan Williams isn't. You know, I think a lot of the Handel stuff is much more. But there's something about the voice being dragged into such perfection around whatever it is, tragedy, comedy or whatever, that is so kind of heart-stopping.
This is Norma Burrows and They're All Gone Now. And that's called They're All Gone Now, and that's music from Vaughan Williams, the choice of Dorothy Cross, a piece of music that she used in an opera. Was that the opera? No, I'm getting confused now. Is that the opera?
That was Riders to the Sea in English National Opera that Fiona Shaw directed.
Okay, yeah. With Fiona Shaw. It must be great, though, to work with someone like Fiona and yourself and everything, because, you know, you're all doing kind of the same thing, but with different skills, different approaches.
Yes, yes, and different
open.
Eyes. So it is fabulous, and it's quite intense. And with Riders of the Sea, you're faced with something that's shown, generally speaking, so conventionally. You know, a little cottage, the mammy, the boys drowning, the horses. And so the exciting part there with the ENO, which is the biggest proscenium in Britain, it's fantastically wide. We created the cottage by having no cottage and projected Paul na Beist into the floor of what would have been the footprint of the cottage. So visually it was stunning. And then you have to deal with things you can't mess with, which is the story, the singing, the music. But what Fiona did was, it wasn't long enough for a whole night in the English National Opera, so we added on Luanatar by Sibelius, which is this beautiful piece of music about a goddess falling from the heavens and landing in the sea, and she's pregnant. And we wove it into the story of Riders, which was about kind of drownings and rebirth and all the rest of it. And we had these beautiful curraghs made down in Cork in a school where they make curraghs, a force scheme on the River Lee, which were brought over to ENO. And at the time, I was very keen to try and bring in the notion of death, because Riders to the Sea is so full of death. And I found a piece of keening recorded by the Smithsonian of a woman keening. And I thought, because that piece of music we just heard is about the mother howling and crying over her dead son's body, her last son who's now died, they're all gone now. And she lists out all their names. It's unbelievably tragic. So I suggested to the then conductor, Richard Hickox, that we bring in the sound of this keening woman underneath the orchestra in the beginning of the Sibelius. And at the time, actually, he thought it was a joke. And the orchestra, they were all very English, and they all thought it was a bit of a joke. I didn't think it was a joke at all. I thought it was an absolutely fabulous idea. And in the end, very sadly, Richard Hickox died in the middle of our rehearsals, which was a tragedy, very suddenly. He was not that old. And what he had chosen was a very faint version of the keening running under. And I was sitting at the opening night going, can I hear it? Can't I hear it? It was there, but it was so faint you could hardly hear it.
What do we know about this recording? Because, as you say, you got it from the Smithsonian. This is not a singer who would have been standing on a stage ever or whatever have performed as a singer. You know, it's not the Sian No singing that we may hear on the radio now and again. Mm. This is the real deal. This whoever this person, we probably don't even have a name for this.
Probably moment. I didn't see any name on my CD, but the, you know, they were hired. Keeners were hired. I didn't realise that. I thought it was your auntie or your cousin who was yowling in sadness, but they were actually hired to sing at these funerals.
This is quite extraordinary, because I did check this out before you came on. It's unbelievable. Quite hard to place even where it's from.
Mm-hmm.
A recording from the Smithsonian there. Dorothy, I don't know where you got that, but that's kind of extraordinary, isn't it?
It's beautiful.
It really
it?
Is, because it's not in any way polished up to be presentable. And of course, I suppose we have to acknowledge that woman's very old.
Very old.
Maybe when she was a younger woman, her voice didn't sound like that. It might have sounded different. But it's nevertheless, it's very, very moving.
And whether there's more respect for an older voice as a keener, I'm not sure.
Yeah, and that was used with Sibelius.
The undercurrent underneath Sibelius.
Wow. It's all part of that thing you were talking about earlier, putting two things together, and that causes it.
Maybe that feels more sacrilegious when it comes to music, doesn't it?
Yeah, but, you know, maybe something. Well, it depends on the attitude. As you say, the conductor did not approve.
That's right.
You know, maybe another conductor would have welcomed it, I don't know.
Yeah.
Are you still travelling a lot, Dorothy? Do you still...?
Not as much as I did, probably. I'm going to India on Saturday.
Fair enough. And is this for pleasure?
It's a residency I've been offered in Varanasi to stay for 6 weeks, where they don't ask you to make any work, which is absolutely beautiful.
Right,
so there's no pressure of having to produce anything.
So I'm not being smart now, but what's in it for them, bringing you there if you're not going to do any work?
It's a foundation called the Sheila Kluwer Foundation, and this woman left some money for artists to go there because it's an extraordinary place. I was there 35 years ago. And the house we live in, it'll be me on my own. Another artist will have left. And apparently there's an opera singer there, an Italian, and a man who runs this foundation called the Alice Bonner Institute. She was Swiss, and she, wealthy family, Switzerland, came across Ravi Shankar's brother, I think Ule Shankar, who was a dancer, adored the dancing and funded his dance troupe around Europe, and then went to live in India when she was 40, bought this house on the Assi Ghat, on the farthest Ghat of India, and lived out most of her life there. She was an artist also, but her passion was this incredible Indian dance. So that's where I live.
You're going to have a great time there, all right.
Yeah.
Now, how does this work? Someone with your mind, Dorothy, and your the way you do, you tie things together, and you seem to be interested in just about everything, you know, that everything that's there. Are you always on? Are you always, in some sense, thinking about work or spotting potential work? I mean, do you ever?
No,
you ever
no,
stop?
I'm not always on. I'm not always on. Thank God. I think I'd die, but I'm probably on too much. Mm-hmm. You know, for my own sanity. So you know, when I say I'm going to India and nobody is demanding that I make any work, it's fabulous. But India is one of the most visually complex, extraordinary, seething places in the world. You know, it's still like the Ganges, where Varanasi is located. It's where they believe that they burn the bodies so that they'll access heaven more. It's a direct hit. And the rituals that they performed on the side of the Ganges every morning 35 years ago were extraordinary. And I think they'll still be a big part of that happening, even though the West has kind of brought in the mobile phone and it's become very different.
But will you be... I mean, I suppose what I'm getting at is if you're exposed to that, and given your interest in what you do for a living, you know, you're going to go into overdrive there, aren't you?
Maybe, but I hope not. I to be honest, I have no idea what I'm going to do there. Mm. That's being absolutely honest. You know, I'll bring a camera, but it's hard to take, especially now when I was younger. Maybe I took it out easier. I don't like holding a camera sometimes in situations like that. So I really, really, really don't know what I... And it's come at a very good time in my life. It'll blast me. It'll completely blast me. And I've just finished a show in New Art Centre in England where I made a piece of work that I loved. And it was carved by stone carvers in Carrara in Italy, in the village where they carved Michelangelo's David and everything. And I made a model of this bed, a little single bed with a pillow and sheets dishevelled. And it's only the size of one human. And it's as if the occupant has left. And I made it in linen and cotton and painted it with tempera. And then these brilliant people copied it by eye with the old point system. And it's just, I adore it. It's exquisite. And it felt like a very big piece for me. And I'm not sure how you follow that. So I also, you know, I think too much work is produced in this world. We're surrounded by too much stuff. So I don't make a lot of work. I never did. Years ago when I made works with Cow's Udders, you know, in the end, people were wanting to buy them after the beginning being repulsed by them and saying they were ghastly things. And I didn't want to make any more because I don't believe in reproducing the same thing ever.
Do you make a lot of work that we don't see?
No, I don't think so. So that's where your question, like, are you ever down? Of course I'm down. Down in terms of not working.
Yeah.
Not down in terms of depression. Well, I might be there too sometimes. But I feed the horse. You know, there's my lovely neighbour's own and he lives on my land. I walk the dog, you know. So I plant trees. So all that is absolute therapy. And it's the antidote to the art, inverted commas, world. I live in Connemara now. I was 40 something when I went there. I'm 62 now. So I couldn't live. I've lots of friends, brilliant artists who are on planes the whole time, go from one museum to the other. It's a choice that I live in that way. And it keeps me sane. It keeps me sane that I look out the window and I see Achill and Clare Island and Cahir and Turk and dolphins and an otter. It keeps the air. It's about a beautiful kind of calming down. A regulation of the nerve ends, you know?
It just sounds incredible. It just sounds wonderful. Your next musical choice, Dorothy, is what?
Will we go into Joan Armatrading to jazz it up a bit?
Dear God, pop music. Joan Armatrading, it's been a while. I am not in love. Joan Armatrading, the choice of Dorothy Cross, is with me in studio. So pop music did make its way into your life at some point,
Dorothy.
Yeah, apart from the Monkees. apart from the Monkees. Now, you presumably are always looking for people with whom you can collaborate. And so let's talk about Lisa Hannigan, who's one of my favourites. I think she's one of the greatest of our own.
Absolutely.
Of the newer people. I mean, she's not new anymore, but to my mind, she's still new.
Yes. Well, I saw her first in this strange kind of incubation chamber in Lismore Castle, where William Burlington and Laura allowed, through Mary Hickson, I think, gathered all these musicians, you know, the Desners, Lisa, and they all stayed in the 22 bedrooms in Lismore Castle. And it was like kind of St. Trinian, so with these people kind of running in and out. And they did a concert of work at the end. And I had never seen Lisa.
Yeah.
And I went, my goodness, she's extraordinary.
Yeah, she
then
is.
Years later, Mary Hickson, who runs a lot of festivals, but Sounds from a Safe Harbour in Cork, asked me, would I like to do a piece of work using a naval vessel? And I said yes immediately, because we nearly had myself and Fiona Shaw back in 2005. And I immediately wanted to do something with voice. And instead of opera, I thought of Lisa. Because of the purity and the fragility and the strength, that contradiction, in conjunction with a naval vessel. And so we recorded Lisa with a man called Alistair Molloy, who plays the glass harmonica. He's one of the world's glass harmonica experts. He's Scottish.
So the glass harmonica, we should point out, is not a harmonica. As we know, it's an harmonica, and it's a sort of, well, it's hard to describe, but lots of glass things on a table.
There are two versions. One is a set of wine glasses full of water, like you do at weddings and try and make a sound. The other is this like armadillo-shaped structure, which are bowls within bowls within bowls.
And you know, Mozart wrote a piece for the glass harmonica.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
And the practitioner uses water on their fingers to make the sound and then use the pedal underneath. So essentially, it's music that can only be made through water. So it was very appropriate, I felt, for the naval ship and Lisa. So we have now got a bank of music which we want to use pumping out from a ship. Hopefully this project called Heartship will happen next year. It didn't happen last year because we weren't able to borrow a heart, which was first found in Cork in 1863 in a church called Christ Church, in a niche in the wall covered in lead. And in those days, if somebody died abroad, sometimes they would send back the heart and not the body. And at the time, Pitt Rivers was a member of the British Army, and he heard about the heart and acquired it. Pitt Rivers is famous for his amazing museum in Oxford, which is kind of a cabinet of wonders, from shrunken heads to canoes to musical instruments to, you know, a heart wrapped in lead found in Cork. And I had seen it in an exhibition in the Wellcome Trust in London several years ago and went, bingo, this is a heart. We need to borrow back, put on the bow of the ship just for one day in a tabernacle of great respect covered in gold and have Lisa sing on the ship. Lisa, the only person visible on the ship, like this singular wanderer, singing songs mainly to do with the heart. So we recorded several pieces in London last year and some of these we can play now.
Now, which one do you want to hear? I've got three here.
Well, you know her song, Prayer for the Dying? Mm-hmm. She does one version with Alistair that's about Prayer for the Dying, but in the middle of it, brilliant Lisa, she started humming My Bonnie Lies Over the Ocean. So, and it is, can you imagine hearing that in relationship with a warship, essentially? Now, the Irish Navy have never shot a gun in warfare, but they have the equipment there. Do My Bonnie.
Okay.
And then you might be able to play her singing Prayer for the Dying.
Yeah, and then her own one. Okay. Extraordinary stuff there, Dorothy. Dorothy Cross brought those recordings in with her. Lisa Hannigan, we were talking before about the hope to use those in a project involving Lisa and a naval vessel. It'd be quite something. It's gorgeous, isn't it?
Gorgeous.
She's such a great singer. Dorothy, we're out of time. I want to thank you for coming in and for putting all the effort in. It's a bit of a chore putting together a lot of music, isn't it?
No, very enjoyable.
Good, good. I'm glad you enjoyed it. And thanks for doing it. You're off to India, so good luck with all that.
Thank you very much.
You'll come back a changed woman.
Shaved
head.
What
did you say? A blast? Is that what you said? It'll be a blast.
Yeah, blast. That's an old-fashioned word, but it's actually a word that is significant, isn't it?
Yeah.
Break down your kind of crustaceans, or what's calcifications?
Exactly.
Is the word,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah. Every so often you feel like that.
Yeah.
Most people just go on the tear for the night.
I suppose so. I don't do that.
but India sounds like the healthy option. Right?
Yeah.
It definitely does. Your last choice, Dorothy, is Leonard Cohen.
Yeah, gorgeous Leonard.
And so what are we going to have? 1,000 Kisses Deep. Dorothy Cross, thanks a million for coming in.
Thank you, John.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast of Mystery Train with John Kelly. Mystery Train hits the rails every Sunday to Thursday at 7 p.m. on 96 to 99 RTE Lyric FM.